He walked to the other end of the battlements and peered down into the sheer depths of the gorge. Far beneath, the Lancre boiled in its eternal mists. He turned and walked into a draught of such icy coldness that he gasped. Unusual breezes plucked at his clothing. There was a strange muttering in his ear, as though someone was trying to talk to him, but couldn't get the speed right. He stood rigid for a moment, getting his breath, and then fled for the door.
"But we're not witches!"
"Why'd you look like them, then? Tie their hands, lads."
"Yes, excuse me, but we're not really witches."
The captain of the guard looked from face to face. His gaze took in their pointy hats, the disordered hair smelling of damp haystacks, the sickly green complexions, and the herd of warts. Guard captain for the Duke wasn't a job that offered long-term prospects for those who used initiative. Three witches had been called for, and these seemed to fit the bill. The captain never went to the theatre. When he was on the rack of adolescence, he had been badly frightened by a Punch and Judy show, and since then he had taken pains to avoid any organized entertainment and had kept away from anywhere where crocodiles could conceivably be expected. He'd spent the last hour enjoying a quiet drink in the guardroom.
"I said tie their hands, didn't I?"
he snapped.
"Shall we gag 'em as well, Captain?"
"But if you just listen, we're with the theatre."
"Yes,"
said the captain, shuddering.
"Gag them."
"Please?"
The captain leaned down and stared at three pairs of frightened eyes. He was trembling.
"That," he said, "is the last time you'll eat anyone's sausage."
He was aware that now the soldiers were giving him odd looks as well. He coughed and pulled himself together.
"Very well, then. My theatrical witches," he said, "you've done your show, and now it's time for your applause."
He nodded to his men.
"Clap them in chains," he said.
Three other witches sat in the gloom behind the stage, staring vacantly into the darkness. Granny Weatherwax had picked up a copy of the script, which she peered at from time to time, as if seeking ideas.
"Divers alarums and excursions," she read uncertainly.
"That means lots of terrible happenings," said McGrath. "You always put that in plays."
"Alarums and what?"
said Nanny Ogg, who hadn't been listening.
"Excursions,"
said McGrath patiently.
"Oh,"
Nanny Ogg brightened a bit.
"The seaside would be nice,"
she said.
"Do shut up, Gaither,"
said Granny Weatherwax.
"They're not for you. They're only for divers, like it says. Probably so they can recover from all them alarums."
"We can't let this happen,"
said McGrath, quickly and loudly.
"If this gets about, witches'll always be old hags with green blusher."
"And meddling in the affairs of kings,"
said Nanny,
"which we never do, as is well known." "It's not the meddling I object to,"
said Granny Weatherwax, her chin on her hand.
"It's the evil meddling."
"And the unkindness to animals,"
muttered McGrath.
"All that stuff about the eye of dog and ear of toad. No one uses that kind of stuff."
Granny Weatherwax and Nanny Ogg carefully avoided one another's faces.
"Drab,"
said Nanny Ogg bitterly.
"Witches just aren't like that," said McGrath. "We live in harmony with the great cycles of nature, and do no harm to anyone, and it's wicked of them to say we don't. We ought to fill their bones with hot lead."
The other two looked at her with a certain amount of surprised admiration. She blushed, although not greenly, and looked at her knees.
"Goody Wemper did a recipe,"
she confessed.
"It's quite easy. What you do is, you get some lead and you—"
"I don't think that would be appropriate,"
said Granny carefully.
after a certain amount of internal struggle. It could give people the wrong idea.
But not for long, said Nanny, wistfully.
No, we can't be having with that sort of thing, said Granny, a little more firmly this time. We'd never hear the last of it.
Why don't we just change the words, said McGrath. When they come back on stage, we could just put the fluents on them so they forget what they're saying and give them some new words.
I suppose you're an expert at theatre words, said Granny sarcastically. They'd have to be the proper sort, otherwise people would suspect.
Shouldn't be too difficult, said Nanny Ogg dismissively. I've been studying it. You go tumpty, tumpty, tumpty.
Granny gave this some consideration.
There's more to it than that, I believe, she said. Some of those speeches were very good. I couldn't understand hardly any of it.
There's no trick to it at all, Nanny Ogg insisted. Anyway, half of them are forgetting their lines as it is. It'll be easy.
We could put words in their mouths, said McGrath. Nanny Ogg nodded.
I don't know about new words, she said, but we could make them forget these words.
They both looked at Granny Weatherwax. She shrugged.
I suppose it's worth a try, she conceded.
Witches as yet unborn will thank us for it, said McGrath ardently.
Oh, good, said Granny. At last! What are you three playing at? We've been looking for you everywhere.
The witches turned to see an irate dwarf trying to loom over them.
Us? Said McGrath. But we're not in...
Oh, yes, you are. Remember, we put you in last week, Act Two, downstage, around the cauldron. You haven't got to say anything. You're symbolising occult forces at work. Just be as wicked as you can. Come on, there's good lads. We've done well so far.
Howell slapped McGrath on the bottom.
Good complexion you got there, Wilf, he said encouragingly. But for goodness sake, use a bit more padding. You're still the wrong shape. Fine warts there, Billum, I must say, he added, standing back. You look as nasty a bunch of hags as a body might hope to clap eyes on. Well done. Shame about the wigs. Now to run along. Curtain up in 1 minute. Break a leg.
He gave McGrath another ringing slap on her rump, slightly hurting his hand, and hurried off to shout at someone else. None of the witches dared to speak. McGrath and Nanny Ogg found themselves instinctively turning toward Granny. She sniffed. She looked up. She looked around. She looked at the brightly lit stage behind her. She brought her hands together with a clap that echoed round the castle, and then rubbed them together.
Useful, she said grimly. Let's do the show right here.
Nanny squinted sullenly after Howell.
Break your own leg, she muttered.
Howell stood in the wings and gave the signal for the curtain, and for the thunder. It didn't come.
Thunder!
He hissed in a voice heard by half the audience.
Get on with it!
A voice from behind the nearest pillar wailed.
I went and bent the thunder, Howell. It just goes clonk, clonk.
Howell stood silent for a moment, counting. The company watched him, awestruck, but not, unfortunately, thunderstruck. At last, he raised his fists to the open sky and said,
I wanted a storm! Just a storm! Not even a big storm, any storm! Now, I want to make myself absolutely clear! I've had enough! I want thunder right now!
A stab of lightning that answered him turned the multi-hued shadows of the castle into blinding white and searing black. It was followed by a roll of thunder, on cue. It was the loudest noise Howell had ever heard. It seemed to start inside his head and work its way outwards. It went on and on, shaking every stone in the castle. Dust rained down. A A distant turret broke away with balletic slowness and, tumbling end over end, dropped gently into the hungry depths of the gorge. When it finished, it left a silence that rang like a bell. Howell looked up at the sky. Great black clouds were blowing across the castle, blotting out the stars. The storm was back. It had spent ages learning its craft. It had spent years lurking in distant valleys. It had practiced for hours in front of a glacier. It had studied the great storms of the past. It had honed its art to perfection. And now, tonight, with what it could see was clearly an appreciative audience waiting for it, it was going to take them by, well, tempest. Howell smiled. Perhaps the gods did listen, after all. He wished he'd asked for a really good wind machine as well. He gestured frantically at Tom John.
Get on with it!
The boy nodded and launched into his main speech. And now our domination is complete. Behind him on the stage, the witches bent over the cauldron.
It's just tin, this one, hissed Nanny. And it's full of all yuck.
And the fire is just red paper, whispered McGrath. It looks so real from up there. It's just red paper. Look, you can poke it.
Never mind, said Granny. Just look busy and wait until I say.
As the evil king and the good duke began the exchange that was going to lead to the exciting duel scene, they became uncomfortably aware of activity behind them, and occasional chuckles from the audience. After a totally inappropriate burst of laughter, Tom John risked a sideways glance. One of the witches was taking their fire to bits. Another one was trying to clean the cauldron. The third one was sitting with her arms folded, glaring at him.
The very soul cries out at tyranny, said Wimslow,
and then caught the expression on Tom John's face and followed his gaze. His voice trailed into silence.
And calls me forth for vengeance,
prompted Tom John helpfully.
But,
whispered Wimslow, trying to point surreptitiously with his dagger.
I wouldn't be seen dead with a cauldron like this, said Nanny Ogg,
in a whisper loud enough to carry to the back of the courtyard.
2 days' work with a scourer and a bucket of sand, is this?
And calls me forth for vengeance, hissed Tom John.
Out of the tail of his eye, he saw Howl in the wings, frozen in an attitude of incoherent rage.
How do they make it flicker? Said McGrath. Be quiet, you two. You're upsetting people.
She raised her hat to Wimslow.
Go ahead, young man. Don't mind us.
What?
Said Wimslow.
Aha! It calls you forth for vengeance, does it?
Said Tom John in desperation.
And the heavens cry revenge, too, I expect.
On cue, the storm produced a thunderbolt that blew the top off another tower. The Duke crouched in his seat, his face a panorama of fear. He extended what once had been a finger.
There they are, he breathed. That's them. What are they doing in my play? Who said they could be in my play?
The Duchess, who was less inclined to deal in rhetorical questions, beckoned to the nearest guard. On stage, Tom John was sweating under the load of the script. Wimslow was incoherent. Now Gummridge, who was playing the part of the good Duchess in a wig of flax, had lost the thread as well.
Aha! Thou callst me an evil king, though thou whisperest it so none save I may hear it, Tom John croaked. And thou hast summoned the guard, possibly by some secret signal owing naught to artifice of lips or tongue.
A guard came on crabwise, still stumbling from Howell's shove. He stared at Granny Weatherwax.
Howell says, what the hell's going on?
He hissed.
What was that?
said Tom John.
Did I hear you say, I come, my lady?
Get these people off, he says.
Tom John advanced to the front of the stage.
Thou babblest, man, see how I dodge thou tortoise spear. I said, see how I dodge thy tortoise spear. Thy spear, man, you're holding it in thy bloody hand, for goodness sake.
The guard gave him a desperate, frozen grin. Tom John hesitated. Three other actors around him were staring fixedly at the witches. Looming up in front of him, with all the inevitability of a tax demand, was a sword fight during which, it was beginning to appear, he would have to parry his own wild thrusts and stab himself to death. He turned to the three witches, his mouth open. For the first time in his life, his awesome memory let him down. He could think of nothing to say. Granny Weatherwax stood up. She advanced to the edge of the stage. The audience held its breath. She held up a hand.
Ghosts of the mind, and all device away, I bid the truth to have...
She hesitated.
It's tumpty-tumpty-day.
Tom John felt the chill engulf him. The others, too, jolted into life. Up from out of the depths of their blank minds, new words rushed. Words red with blood and revenge. Words that had echoed among the castle stones. Words stored in silicone. Words that would have themselves heard. Words that gripped their mouth so tightly that an attempt not to say them would result in a broken jaw.
"Do you fear him now?"
said Gumridge.
"And he so mazed with drink? Take his dagger, husband. You are a blade's width from the kingdom."
"I dare not,"
Wimslow said, trying to look in astonishment at his own lips.
"Who will know?"
Gumridge waved a hand towards the audience. He'd never act so well again.
"See, there's only eyeless knight. Take the dagger now. Take the kingdom tomorrow. Have a stab at it, man."
Wimslow's hand shook.
"I have it, wife,"
he said.
"Is this a dagger I see before me?"
"Of course it's a bloody dagger. Come on, do it now. The weak deserve no mercy. We'll say he fell down the stairs."
"But people will suspect."
"Are there no dungeons? Are there no pillywinks? Possession is nine parts of the lore, husband. When what you possess is a knife."
Wimslow drew his arm back.
"I cannot. He has been kindness itself to me."
"And you can be death itself to him."
Daffy could hear the voices a long way off. He adjusted his mask, checked the deathliness of his appearance in the mirror, and peered at the script in the empty backstage gloom.
"Cower no, brief mortals," he said. "I am Death. Gainst who? Gainst who?
Whom?"
"Oh, thanks," said the boy distractedly. "Gainst whom no lock may hold, will hold, nor fastened portal bar. Here to...
"Here to take my tally on this night of kings."
Duffy sagged.
"Oh, you're so much better at it," he moaned. "You've got the right voice, and you can remember the words." He turned around. "It's only three lines, and how will...
have my guts..." He froze. His eyes widened and became two sources of fear as Death snapped his fingers in front of the boy's rigid face.
"Forget,"
he commanded, and turned and stalked silently towards the wings. His eyeless skull took in the line of costumes, the waxy debris of the makeup table. His empty nostrils snuffed up the mixed smells of mothballs, grease, and sweat. There was something here, he thought, that nearly belonged to the gods. Humans had built a world inside the world, which reflected it in pretty much the same way as a drop of water reflects the landscape. And yet... Inside this little world, they had taken pains to put all the things you might think they would want to escape from. Hatred, fear, tyranny, and so forth. Death was intrigued. They thought they wanted to be taken out of themselves, and every art humans dreamt up took them further in. He was fascinated. He was here for a very particular and precise purpose. There was a soul to be claimed. There was no time for inconsequentialities. But what was time, after all? His feet did an involuntary little clicking dance across the stones, alone in the grey shadows. Death tap-danced.
The next night in your dressing room they hang a star.
He pulled himself together, adjusted his scythe, and waited silently for his cue. He'd never missed one yet. He was going to get out there and slay them.
And you can be death itself to him.
Now!
Death entered, his feet clicking across the stage.
Cower now, brief mortals, for I am death, against whom no, against whom...
He hesitated. He hesitated for the very first time in the eternity of his existence. For although the death of the Discworld was used to dealing with people by the million, at the same time, every death was intimate and personal. Death was seldom seen except by those of an occult persuasion and his clients themselves. The reason that no one else saw him was that the human brain is clever enough to edit sights too horrible for it to cope with. But the problem here was that several hundred people were, in fact, expecting to see death at this point, and were therefore seeing him. Death turned slowly and stared back at the hundreds of watching eyes. Even in the grip of the truth, Tom John recognized a fellow actor in distress, and fought for mastery of his lips.
"Lock will hold,"
he whispered, through teeth fixed in a grimace. Death gave him a manic grin of stage fright.
"What?"
he whispered, in a voice like an anvil being hit with a small lead hammer.
"Lock will hold your fastened portal," said Tom John encouragingly.
"Lock will hold nor fastened portal,
repeated Death, desperately watching his lips.
"Bar!
Bar!
No, I cannot do it," said Winslow. "I will be seen. Down there in the hall, someone watches." "There is no one. I feel the stare. Dithering idiot! Must I put in for you? See, his foot is upon the top stair."
Wimslow's face contorted with fear and uncertainty. He drew back his hand.
"No!"
The scream came from the audience. The Duke was half risen from his seat, his tortured knuckles in his mouth. As they watched, he lurched forward between the shocked people.
"No! I did not do it. It was not like that. You cannot say it was like that. You were not there!"
He stared at the upturned faces around him and sagged.
"Nor was I!"
he giggled.
"I was asleep at the time, you know. I remember it quite well. There was blood on the counterpane. There was blood on the floor. I could not wash off the blood. But these are not proper subjects for the inquiry. I cannot allow the discussion of national security. It was just a dream. And when I awoke, he'd be alive tomorrow.
And tomorrow it wouldn't have happened because it was not done. And tomorrow you can say, I did not know. And tomorrow you can say, I had no recollection. What a noise he made in falling, enough to wake the dead. Who'd have thought he had so much blood in him?
By now, he had climbed onto the stage and grinned brightly at the assembled company.
I hope that sorts it all out,
he said. In the silence that followed, Tom John opened his mouth to utter something suitable, something soothing, and found that there was nothing he could say. But another personality stepped into him, took over his lips, and spoke thusly.
With my own bloody dagger, you bastard! I know it was you. I saw you at the top of the stairs, sucking your thumb. I'd kill you now, except for the thought of having to spend eternity listening to your whining. I, Verence, formerly king of...
What testimony is this?
Said the Duchess. She stood in front of the stage, with half a dozen soldiers beside her.
These are just slanders,
she added.
And treason to boot, the rantings of mad players.
I was bloody king of Loncra,
shouted Tom John.
In which case you are the alleged victim,
said the Duchess calmly,
and unable to speak to the prosecution. It is against all precedent.
Tom John's body turned towards death.
You were there. You saw it all.
I suspect I would not be considered an appropriate witness.
Therefore, there is no proof, and where there is no proof, there is no crime,
said the Duchess. She motioned the soldiers forward.
So much for your experiment,
she said to her husband.
I think my way is better.
She looked around the stage and found the witches.
Arrest them,
she said.
No,
said the fool, stepping out of the wings.
What did you say?
I saw it all, said the fool simply. I was in the great hall that night. You killed the king, my lord.
I did not,
screamed the duke.
You are not there. I did not see you there. I order you not to be there.
You did not dare say this before,
said Lady Filmot.
Yes, lady, but I must say it now.
The duke focused unsteadily on him.
You swore loyalty unto death, my fool,
he hissed. Yes, my lord, I'm sorry.
You're dead!
The duke snatched a dagger from Winslow's unresisting hand, darted forward, and plunged it to the hilt into the fool's heart. McCrat screamed. The fool rocked back and forth unsteadily.
Thank goodness that's over,
he said, as McGrath pushed her way through the actors and clasped him to what could charitably be called her bosom. It struck the fool that he had never looked at a bosom squarely in the face, at least since he was a baby, and it was particularly cruel of the world to save the experience until after he was dead. He gently moved one of McGrath's arms and pulled the despicable horned cowl from his head and tossed it as far as possible. He didn't have to be a fool any more, or, he realized, bother about vows or anything. What with bosoms as well, death seemed to be an improvement.
I didn't do it,
said the duke. No pain, thought the fool. Funny, that. On the other hand, you obviously can't feel pain when you are dead. It would be wasted.
You all saw that I didn't do it,
said the duke. Death gave the fool a puzzled look. Then he reached into the recesses of his robe and pulled out an hourglass. It had bells on it. He gave it a gentle shake, which made them tinkle.
I gave no orders that any such thing should be done,
said the duke calmly. His voice came from a long way off, from wherever his mind was now. The company stared at him wordlessly. It wasn't possible to hate someone like this, only to feel acutely embarrassed about being anywhere near him. Even the fool felt embarrassed, and he was dead. Death tapped the hourglass and then peered at it to see if it had gone wrong.
"You're all lying," said the Duke in tranquil tones. "Telling lies is naughty."
He stabbed several of the nearest actors in a dreamy, gentle way, and then held up the blade.
"You see," he said, "no blood. It wasn't me."
He looked up at the Duchess, towering over him now like a red tsunami over a small fishing village.
"It was her," he said. "She did it."
He stabbed her once or twice on general principles, and then stabbed himself, and let the dagger drop from his fingers. After a few seconds' reflection, he said in a voice far nearer the worlds of sanity,
"You can't get me now."
He turned to Death.
"Will there be a comet?" he said.
"There must be a comet when a prince dies. I'll go and see, shall I?"
He wandered away. The audience broke into applause.
"You've got to admit, he was real royalty," said Nanny Ogg, eventually. "It only goes to show royalty goes eccentric far better than the likes of you and me."
Death held the hourglass to his skull, his face radiating puzzlement. Granny Weatherwax picked up the fallen dagger and tested the blade with her finger. It slid into the handle quite easily, with a faint squeaking noise. She passed it to Nanny.
"There's your magic sword," she said.
McGrath looked at it, and then back at the fool.
"Are you dead or not?" she said.
"I must be,"
said the fool, his voice slightly muffled.
"I think I'm in paradise."
"No, look, I'm serious."
"I don't know, but I'd like to breathe."
"Then you must be alive."
"Everyone's alive," said Granny. "It's a trick dagger. Actors probably can't be trusted with real ones. After all, they can't even keep a cauldron clean," said Nanny.
"Whether everyone is alive or not is a matter for me," said the Duchess. "As ruler, it is my pleasure to decide. Clearly my husband has lost his wits."
She turned to her soldiers.
"And I decree..."
"Now,"
hissed King Verence in Granny's ear.
"Now."
Granny Weatherwax drew herself up.
"Be silent, woman," she said. "The true King of Lancre stands before you."
She clapped Tom John on the shoulder.
"What, him?"
"Who, me?"
"Ridiculous," said the Duchess. "He's a mummer of sorts."
"She's right, miss," said Tom John, on the edge of panic. "My father runs a theatre, not a kingdom."
"He is the true king. We can prove it," said Granny.
"Oh, no," said the Duchess. "We're not having that. There's no mysterious returned heirs in this kingdom. Guards, take him."
Granny Weatherwax held up a hand. The soldiers lurched from foot to foot uncertainly.
"She's a witch, isn't she?" said one of them, tentatively.
"Certainly,"
said the Duchess. The guards shifted uneasily.
"We've seen where they turn people into newts," said one. "And then shipwreck them." "Yeah, and alarm the divers." "Yeah." "We ought to talk about this. We ought to get extra for witches."
"She could do anything to us, look. She could be a dreb, even."
"Don't be foolish," said the Duchess. "Witches don't do that sort of thing. They're just stories to frighten people."
The guard shook his head.
"It looked pretty convincing to me."
"Of
course it did. It was meant.
The Duchess began. She sighed and snatched a spear out of the guard's hand.
I'll show you the power of these witches, she said,
and hurled it at Granny's face. Granny moved her hand across at snake-bite speed and caught the spear just behind the head.
So, she said, and it comes to this, does it?
You don't frighten me, weird sisters,
said the Duchess. Granny stared her in the eye for a few seconds. She gave a grunt of surprise.
You're right, she said. We really don't, do we?
Do you think I haven't studied you? Your witchcraft is all artifice and illusion to amaze weak minds. It holds no fear for me. Do your worst.
Granny studied her for a while.
My worst, she said eventually.
Magrat and Nanny Og shuffled gently out of the way. The Duchess laughed.
You're clever, she said. I'll grant you that much. And quick, come on, hag. Bring on your toads and demons. I'll...
She stopped, her mouth opening and shutting a bit without any words emerging. Her lips drew back in a rictus of terror. Her eyes looked beyond Granny, beyond the world, towards something else. One knuckled hand flew to her mouth, and she made a little whimpering noise. She froze, like a rabbit that had just seen a stoat and knows, without any doubt, that this is the last stoat that it will ever see.
"What have you done to her?"
said Magrat, the first to dare to speak. Granny smirked.
"Edology," said Granny, and smirked. "You don't need any Black Alice magic for it."
What have you done?
No one becomes like she is without building walls inside her head, she said. I've just knocked them down. Every scream, every plea, every pang of guilt, every twinge of conscience, all at once. There's a little trick to it.
She gave Magrat a condescending smile.
I'll show you one day, if you like.
Magrat thought about it.
"Horrible," she said.
"Nonsense,"
Granny smiled terribly.
"Everyone wants to know their true self. Now she does."
"Sometimes you have to be kind to be cruel," said Nanny Og approvingly.
"I think it's probably the worst thing that could happen to anyone," said Magrat, as the Duchess swayed backwards and forwards.
"For goodness sake, use your imagination, girl," said Granny. "There are far worse things. Needles under the fingernails, for one. Stuff with pliers.
Red-hot knives up the jacksy,"
said Nanny Og.
"Handle first, too, so you can cut your fingers trying to pull them out." "This is simply the worst that I can do," said Granny Weatherwax primly. "It's all right and proper, too. A witch should act like that, you know. There's no need for any dramatic stuff. Most magic goes on in the head. It's headology. Now, if you—"
A noise like a gas leak escaped from the Duchess's lips. Her head jerked back suddenly. She opened her eyes, blinked, and focused on Granny. Sheer hatred suffused her features.
"Guards!" she said. "I told you to take them!"
Granny's jaw sagged.
"What?"
she said.
But I showed you your true self."
"I'm supposed to be upset by that, am I?"
As the soldiers sheepishly grabbed Granny's arms, the Duchess pressed her face close to Granny's, her tremendous eyebrows a V of triumphant hatred.
"I'm supposed to grovel on the floor, is that it? Well, old woman, I've seen exactly what I am, do you understand? And I'm proud of it. I'll do it all again, only hotter and longer. I enjoyed it, and I did it because I wanted to."
She thumped the vast expanse of her chest.
"You gawping idiots," she said. "You're so weak. You really think that people are basically decent underneath, don't you?"
The crowd on the stage backed away from the sheer force of her exultation.
"Well, I've looked underneath," said the Duchess. "I know what drives people. It's fear. Sheer, deep-down fear. There's not one of you who doesn't fear me. I can make you whittle your drawers out of terror, and now I'm going to take—"
At this point, Nanny Ogg hit her on the back of the head with the cauldron.
"She does go on, doesn't she?" she said conversationally, as the Duchess collapsed. "She was a bit eccentric, if you ask me."
There was a long, embarrassed silence. Granny Weatherwax coughed. Then she treated the soldiers holding her to a bright, friendly smile and pointed to the mound that was now the Duchess.
"Take her away and put her in a cell somewhere," she commanded.
The men snapped to attention, grabbed the Duchess by her arms, and pulled her upright with considerable difficulty.
"Gently, mind," said Granny.
She rubbed her hands together and turned to Tom John, who was watching her with his mouth open.
"Depend upon it," she hissed. "Here and now, my lad, you don't have a choice. You're the King of Lancre."
"But I don't know how to be a king."
"We all seed you. You had it down just right, including the shouting."
"That's just acting."
"Act, then. Being a king is...
Granny hesitated and snapped her fingers at McGrath.
"What do you call them things? There's always 100 of them in anything."
McGrath looked bewildered.
"Do you mean percent?"
Tom John looked at the faces of the Lancre worthies around the table. They had a keen, calculating look, like the audience at a Fatstock show. They were weighing him up. It crept upon him, in a cold and clammy way, that once he was king, he could do anything he wanted, provided that what he wanted to do was be king.
"You could build up your own theatre,"
said Howell, his eyes lighting up for a moment.
"With as many trapdoors as you wanted, and magnificent costumes. You could act in a new play every night. I mean, it would make the disc look like a shed."
"Would you come and see me?"
said Tom John, sagging in his seat.
"Everyone."
"What? Every night?"
"You could order them to,"
said Howell, without looking up. I knew he was going to say that, Tom John thought. "He can't really mean it," he added charitably. "He's got his play. He doesn't really exist in this world, not right now at the moment." He took off the crown and turned it over and over in his hands. There wasn't much metal in it, but it felt heavy. He wondered how heavy it would get if he wore it all the time. At the head of the table was an empty chair containing, he had been assured, the ghost of his real father. It would have been nice to report that he had experienced anything more, when being introduced to it, than an icy sensation and a buzzing in the ears.
"I suppose I could help Father pay off the disc," he said.
"That would be nice, yes," said Howell.
He spun the crown in his fingers and listened glumly to the talk flowing back and forth over his head.
15 years,
said the Mayor of Lancre.
"We had to," said Granny Weatherwax. "I thought the baker was a bit early last week." "No, no," said the witch impatiently. "It doesn't work like that. No one's lost anything."
"According to my figuring,"
said the man who doubled as Lancre's beadle, town clerk, and gravedigger,
"we've all lost 15 years.
"No, we've all gained them," said the mayor. "Stands to reason. Times like this sort of wiggly road, see? But we took a short cut across the fields."
"Not at all,"
said the clerk, sliding a sheet of paper across the table. "Look here!" Tom John let the waters of debate close over him again. Everyone wanted him to be king. No one thought twice about what he wanted. His views didn't count. Yes, that was it. No one wanted him to be king. Not precisely him. He just happened to be convenient. Gold does not tarnish, at least physically. But Tom John felt that the thin band of metal in his hand had an unpleasant depth to its luster. It had sat on too many troubled heads. If you held it to your ear, you could hear the screams. He became aware of someone else looking at him, their gaze playing across his face like a blow lamp on a lolly. He looked up. It was the third witch, the youngest one, with the intense expression and the hedgerow hairstyle, sitting next to Old Fool, as though she owned a controlling interest. It wasn't his face she was examining, it was his features. Her eyeballs were tracking him from nape to nose like a pair of calipers. He gave her a little brave smile, which she ignored, just like everyone else, he thought. Only the fool noticed him, and returned the smile with an apologetic grin and a tiny conspiratorial wave of the fingers that said, "What are we doing here, two sensible people like us?" The woman was looking at him again, turning her head this way and that and narrowing her eyes. She kept glancing at the fool and back to Tom John. Then she turned to the oldest witch, the only person in the entire hot, damp room who seemed to have acquired a mug of beer, and whispered in her ear. The two started a spirited, whispered conversation. It was, thought Tom John, a particularly feminine way of talking. It normally took place on doorsteps, with all the participants standing with their arms folded, and if anyone was so ungracious as to walk past, they'd stop abruptly and watch them in silence until they were safely out of earshot. He became aware that Granny Weatherwax had stopped talking, and that the entire hall was staring at him expectantly. "Hello?" he said.
"It might be a good idea to hold the coronation tomorrow," said Granny. "It's not good for a kingdom to be without a ruler. It doesn't like it."
She stood up, pushed back her chair, and came and took Tom John's hand. He followed her unprotestingly across the flagstones and up the steps to the throne, where she had put her hands on his shoulders and pressed him gently down onto the threadbare red plush cushions. There was a scraping of benches and chairs. He looked around in panic. "What's happening now?" he said.
"Don't worry," said Granny firmly. "Everyone wants to come and swear loyalty to you. You just nod graciously and ask everyone what they do and if they enjoy it. Oh, and you'd better give them the crown back."
Tom John removed it quickly.
"Why?"
he said.
"They want to present it to you."
"But I've already got it,"
said Tom John desperately. Granny gave a patient sigh.
"Only in the, what's the name, real sense," she said. "This is more ceremonial."
"You mean unreal?"
"Yes," said Granny, "but much more important."
Tom John gripped the arms of the throne.
"Fetch me Howl," he said.
"No, you must do it like that. It's precedent, you see. First you meet the..."
"I said, fetch me the dwarf. Didn't you hear me, woman?"
This time, Tom John got the spin and pitch of his voice just right. But Granny rallied magnificently.
"I don't think you quite realize who you are talking to, young man," she said.
Tom John half rose in his seat. He had played a great many kings, and most of them weren't the kind of kings who shook hands graciously and asked people whether they enjoyed their work. They were far more the type of kings who got people to charge into battle at 5 o'clock on freezing mornings, and still managed to persuade them that this was better than being in bed. He summoned them all and treated Granny Weatherwax to a blast of royal hauteur, pride and arrogance.
"We thought we were talking to a subject," he said. "Now, do as we say."
"We thought you'd be up at the top table kind of thing," said Nanny. "We thought you'd have moved in up there."
McGrath stared fixedly at her feet. "I wasn't invited," she said meekly.
"Well, I don't know about invited," said Granny. "We weren't invited. People don't have to invite witches. They just know we'll turn up if we want to. They soon find room for us," she added, with some satisfaction.
"You see, he's been very busy," said McGrath to her feet. "Sorting everything out, you know. He's very clever, you know, underneath."
"Very sober lad," said Nanny.
"Anyway, it's full moon," said McGrath quickly. "You've got to go to coven meetings at full moon, no matter what other pressing engagements they may be."
"Have you?"
Nanny Ogg began, but Granny nudged her sharply in the ribs.
"It's a very good thing he's paying so much attention to getting the kingdom working again," said Granny soothingly. "It shows proper consideration. I dare say he'll get around to everything sooner or later. It's very demanding being a king."
"Yes," said McGrath, her voice barely audible. The silence that followed was almost solid. It was broken by Nanny in a voice as bright and brittle as ice.
"Well, I brought a bottle of that fizzy wine with me," she said. In case we felt like a drink," she rallied, and waved it at the other two.
"I don't want any," said McGrath sullenly.
"You drink up, girl," said Granny Weatherwax. "It's a chilly night. It'd be good for your chest."
She squinted at McGrath as the moon drifted out from behind its cloud.
"Here," she said. "Your hair looks a bit grubby. It looks as though you haven't washed it for a month."
McGrath burst into tears. The same moon shone down on the otherwise unremarkable town of Ram Nitz, some 90 miles from Loncra. Tom John left the stage to thunderous applause at the concluding act of The Troll of Ankh. 100 people would go home tonight, wondering whether trolls were really as bad as they had hitherto thought, although, of course, this wouldn't actually stop them disliking them in any way whatsoever. Howell patted him on the back as he sat down at the makeup table and started scraping off the thick grey sludge that was intended to make him look like a walking rock.
"Well done," he said. "That love scene, just right. And when you turned around and roared at the wizard, I shouldn't think there was a dry seat in the house."
"I know." Howell rubbed his hands together.
"We can afford a tavern tonight," he said. "So if we just..."
"We'll sleep in the carts," said Tom John firmly, squinting at himself in the shard of mirror.
"But you know how much the the king gave us. It could be feather beds all the way home."
"It's straw mattresses and a good profit for us," said Tom John. "And that'll buy you gods from heaven and demons from hell, and the wind and the waves, and more trapdoors than you can count, my lawn ornament." Howell's hand rested on Tom John's shoulder for a moment. Then he said,
"You're right, boss."
"Certainly I am. How's the play going?"
"Huh? What play?"
said Howell innocently. Tom John carefully removed a plaster-brow ridge. "You know," he said. "That one, the Loncra King."
"Oh, coming along. Coming along, you know. I'll get it right one of these days."
Howell changed the subject with speed.
"You know, we could work our way down the river and take a boat home. That would be nice, wouldn't it?"
"But we could work our way home, overland, and pick up some more cash. That would be better, wouldn't it?" Tom John grinned. "We took 100 threepence tonight. I counted heads during the judgment speech. That's nearly 1 silver piece after expenses."
You're your father's son and no mistake, said Howell.
Tom John sat back and looked at himself in the mirror.
Yes, he said. I thought I'd better be.
McGrath didn't like cats and hated the idea of mouse traps. She'd always felt that it should be possible to come to some sort of arrangement with creatures like mice, so that all available food was rationed in the best interests of all parties. This was a very humanitarian outlook, which is to say that it was not a view shared by mice, and therefore her moonlit kitchen was alive. When there was a knocking at the door, the half floor appeared to rush towards the walls. After a few seconds, the knocking came again. There was another pause. Then the knocking rattled the door on its hinges, and a voice cried,
"Open in the name of the king!"
A second voice said in hurt tones, "You don't have to shout like that. Why did you shout like that? I didn't order you to shout like that. It's enough to frighten anybody shouting like that."
"Sorry, sire. It goes with the job, sire."
"Just knock again a bit more gently, please." The knocking might have been a bit softer. McGrath's apron dropped off its hook on the back of the door. "You sure I can't do it myself?"
"It's not done, sire. King's knocking at humble cottage doors. Best leave it to me." "Open in the..."
"Sergeant!"
"Sorry, sire. Forgot myself."
"Try the latch." There was the sound of someone being extremely hesitant.
"Don't like the sound of that, sire," said the invisible sergeant. "Could be dangerous. If you want my advice, sire, I'd set fire to the thatch."
"Fire?"
"Yes, sir. We always do that if they don't answer the door. Brings them out a treat."
"I don't think that would be appropriate, Sergeant. I think I'll try the latch if it's all the same to you."
"Breaks my heart to see you do it, sir."
"Well, I'm sorry."
"You could at least let me buff it up for you."
"No."
"Well, couldn't I just set fire to the privy?"
"Absolutely not."
"That chicken house over there looks as if it could go up like a..." "Sergeant!"
"Sir?" "Go back to the castle."
"What?"
"Leave you all alone, sir." "This is a matter of extreme delicacy, Sergeant. I'm sure you are a man of sterling qualities, but there are times when even a king needs to be alone. It concerns a young woman, you understand."
"Ah, point taken, sir."
And hiccup.
"Why?"
"None of them would have believed me if you hadn't spoken up."
"Only because we was asked," said Granny.
"Yes, but everyone knows witches don't lie. That's the important thing. I mean, everyone could see they looked so alike. But that could have been coincidence. You see..." McGrath blushed. "I looked up Droit de Seigneur. Goody Whimper had a dictionary." Nanny Ogg stopped singing.
"Yes," said Granny Weatherwax. "Well?"
McGrath became aware of an uncomfortable atmosphere.
"You did tell the truth, didn't you?" she said. "They really are brothers, aren't they?"
"Oh, yes," said Gaither Ogg. "Definitely. I saw to his mother when you're... when the new king was born, and to the queen when young Tom John was born, and she told me who the father was." "Gaither?"
"Sorry."
The wine was going to her head, but the wheels in McGrath's mind still managed to turn.
"Just a minute," she said. "I remember the fool's father," said Nanny Ogg, speaking slowly and deliberately. "Very personable young man he was. He didn't get on with his dad, you know, but he used to visit sometimes to see old friends."
"He made friends easily," said Granny.
"Among the ladies," agreed Nanny. "Very athletic, wasn't he? Could climb walls like nobody's business, I remember hearing."
He was very popular at court, said Granny. I know that much.
Oh, yes, with the Queen at any rate.
The King used to go out hunting such a lot, said Granny. It was that dwarf of his.